Matthew Arnold was an English poet. He was a cultural critic who lived and died in the 1800s. He was the son of Thomas Arnold, the famed headmaster of Rugby School. Rugby School is an independent boarding school in Rugby, Warwickshire, England. It's one of the oldest independent schools in Britain. And the father of Matthew, as I indicated, was headmaster there from 1828 to 1841. Matthew Arnold wrote a very lengthy poem, or at least lengthy by my judgment. I'm not big on poetry, and I tried to go through the thing, and it's a little too long for me. But nonetheless, it's called Rugby School. A select portion of the poem says this: most men eddy about. Now, it's not a word we use a lot, so I'll define it. Eddy means to swirl, to move in a circular way. It's used of water, it's used of air, used of smoke. He says, most men eddy about here and there, eat and drink, chatter and love and hate, gather and squander, are raised aloft, are hurled in the dust, striving blindly, achieving nothing, and then they die. Sounds like an excerpt from the book of Ecclesiastes, doesn't it? Ecclesiastes 1, verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Well-known phrase in the book of Ecclesiastes, also a well-known word, vanity, that's found in that book. If you mention the word vanity to most people, you will probably get some different responses. Some might start singing the old Carly Simon song, released back in 1972, November. You're so vain. You probably think this song is about you. Vanity in this sense is defined by the dictionary as excessive pride in or admiration of one's own appearance or achievements. Synonyms include conceited, narcissism, self-love. Others might think, sorry, I didn't have Carly up there. Forgot to give her credit where credit's due. Others may think of a dressing table. It's another dictionary definition for girls, women, putting on makeup, jewelry, perhaps other things that you need a mirror for. Still others may think of a bathroom unit, defined by the dictionary, consisting of a wash basin typically set into a counter with a cabinet beneath. Continuing with these definitions, fewer people still might think of vanity as denoting a person or company that publishes works at the author's expense. It's called vanity press. But the last definition is the one that concerns us. And that's the definition, the quality of being worthless or futile. Synonyms include futility, uselessness, pointlessness, worthlessness. Futility, as defined by Byron earlier, is incapable of producing any useful result. If you can't read that line at the bottom there, the cat trying to drink the water out of the glass, it says, no matter how hard you try, you will fail. That's futility. That's what it's like when you're seeking fulfillment in things, in people, in activities, in this world. Perhaps the adjective form of the word is more commonly used in the sense of vanity. We talk about things being vain. She searched in vain for the book. It was a futile search. It was a vain attempt to clean the room. We talk about the greatest of things, like the book of all books, or the war of all wars, or we're familiar with the Hebrew superlatives in the Bible, the Song of Songs, or the Holy of Holies, in more modern translations interpreted or translated the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. And so the phrase we're talking about is vanity of vanities. It suggests the ultimate absurdity, the ultimate emptiness. The word vanity means breath, vapor, speaks of that which is quickly passing. Frank J. Wisner, owner of Colorado's Cripple Creek Brewing, created the first root beer float in August 19, 1893. The idea was born when Wisner noticed that the snowy peaks on Colorado's Cow Mountain looked like ice cream floating in soda. Around the year 1900, a teenage boy and his little 8-year-old brother were on their annual trek into town for the fair. They'd heard about root beer floats and they wanted to try one. When they got to the soda stand, the older brother said, "Johnny, you let me buy one first and try it." So he bought one and he started tasting it. And he said, "Save your money, Johnny. It ain't nothing but sweet air." That's sort of like the word vanity. It's something that quickly disappears, leaves nothing behind, and does not satisfy. It's been compared to how you can see your breath when it's cold outside. One language professor defined it as whatever is left after you pop a soap bubble. Jeremiah used this word to denounce idolatry as worthless in Jeremiah 18, verse 15. Jeremiah chapter 10, he uses the word twice in the two texts that I'm going to read. Verses 1 through 5 says, "Hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of heaven. For the Gentiles are dismayed at them, for the customs of the people are futile." There's the word. "For one cuts a tree down from the forest, the work of the hands of the workman with the axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. They are upright like a palm tree and they cannot speak." Of course, he's talking about idols here. "They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor can they do any good." They're worthless. They're empty. They're vain. They're futile. Verses 14 and 15 of the same chapter, "Everyone is dull-hearted, without knowledge. Every metalsmith is put to shame by the graven image. For his molded image is falsehood, and there is no breath in them. They are futile, a work of errors." Job used the word to bemoan the brevity of life in chapter 7 and verse 16 when he said, "My days are but a breath." But before we go further, let's bring in another oft-used phrase in the book of Ecclesiastes, and that phrase is "under the sun." This phrase occurs 29 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. 3 times the synonymous phrase "under heaven" is found. Ecclesiastes 1:13, "I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised." Chapter 2, verse 3, "I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives." Chapter 3, verse 1, he talks of a time for every purpose under heaven or under the sun. Another synonymous phrase is "on earth." It's found a few times. I'll mention 2 of those. Ecclesiastes 8:14, "There's a vanity which occurs on earth or under the sun. That there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. There are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous." I said this also is vanity. Chapter 8 and verse 16, "I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth." So these phrases, "under the sun," "under heaven," and "on earth," define the outlook of the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes as he looks at life from a human perspective. not taking into account God, not taking into account the spiritual. He's just viewing life as what we see down here as we go through it. Throughout most of this book, his focus is on that. He changes that in the last portion of the book. But so when Solomon says vanity of vanities, all is vanity, he's talking about the vanity of trying to find ultimate satisfaction in things on this earth. Finally, about this word vanity, there are some translations that render it differently. They will use the word nonsense or senselessness. New International Version and the New Living Translation translate it meaningless. Each of these words carry ideas that are not inherent in the word. And as I understand, we should not really think of what is meaningless or senseless, but again, that which is quickly passing. Our word this morning is found 38 times in Ecclesiastes, only 12 chapters long, 38 times, only 34 times in the rest of the entire Old Testament. Writer is telling us that life is a fleeting thing that needs to be savored and enjoyed as a gift from God. But the purpose of using this term is to teach us that all these temporary things are things that we should not try to hold on to, like trying to hold on to that breath of air that comes out of your mouth that you see when it's cold outside, like trying to hold on to that soap bubble that you just popped. We can and we should enjoy them. We can and we should appreciate them. But if we try to make them more meaningful, more lasting than they really are, they will become thorns in our sides, because that's equivalent to trying to grasp the wind. Another one of those phrases, which is used 9 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. Talk about an effort of frustration, an exercise in futility, trying to grasp the wind. Ecclesiastes 2:11, I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. The book virtually begins with this statement, all is vanity. It's repeated time and time again. Prior to describing his search for meaning in chapter 1 and verse 14, Solomon says, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. That phrase is repeated several times throughout this book. I'm going to go through some verses. I'm not going to read the verses. I'm just going to call our attention to what the verses say. They will appear on the screen as well. Chapter 2, verse 1, he talks about the vanity of pleasure. Chapter 2, verses 11, 22, and 4 talks about the vanity of labor. He talks about the vanity of human wisdom in chapter 2, verse 15. He's not saying there's not any advantage to wisdom, but he says that in the end, the wise man dies just like the fool. He talks about the vanity of life. Chapter 2, verse 17, the vanity of leaving an inheritance. Chapter 2, verses 18 through 21. Going to leave it to somebody who didn't work for it. So what was the advantage of spending all that time working and storing this stuff up only to leave it to somebody else? The vanity of earthly existence, the vanity of acquiring riches over family, the vanity of political popularity, the vanity of many dreams and many words, the vanity of loving abundance, the vanity of wealth without the gift of God to enjoy it, the vanity of wandering desire, the vanity of foolish laughter, the vanity of injustice in this life, the vanity of the days of darkness, the vanity of childhood and youth. Vanity of vanities, lamented Solomon. All is emptiness, futility. It's like a vapor. It's like that which vanishes quickly and leaves nothing behind. From the human point of view, that is, under the sun, life does indeed appear futile, and it can be easy to be pessimistic. Jewish writer Sholo Aleichem once said life was a blister on top of a tumor and a boil on top of that. British playwright George Bernard Shaw said that life was a series of inspired follies. In the book of Ecclesiastes, haven't read those first three verses. Luke did that for us. Verses 2 and 3, vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit, he asks in verse 3, has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? What profit does a man have from all his labor? Man's life is filled with labor and activity, but where does it get him when all is said and done? The word usually translated profit is found 10 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. It can be translated surplus, advantage, gain. Might say that man is on a treadmill. You ask him why he works, and he says, maybe, well, to get money. But why does he want money? Well, to buy food. Why does he want food? To maintain his strength. Why does he need to maintain his strength? Well, so he can work. There he is, right back where he began. Treadmill of life. Thoreau observed, men live lives of quiet desperation. It was H.L. Mencken who said, the basic fact about human experience is not that it's a tragedy, but that it's a bore. It's not that it's predominantly painful, but that it's lacking in any sense. When sin entered the world, people chose to become self-centered and self-guided rather than God-centered and God-guided. They became earthbound. They became frustrated. Ecclesiastes demonstrates that there's no firm foundation under the sun for earthbound people to build on so as to find meaning, satisfaction, and the key to existence. G. Campbell Morgan summarized Solomon's outlook in this book in this manner. He said, this man had been living through all these experiences under the sun, concerned with nothing above the sun, until there came a moment in which he had seen the whole of life, and there was something above the sun. It is only as a man takes account of that which is above the sun, as well as that which is under the sun, that things under the sun are seen in their true light. Everything that the world has to offer, all put together, cannot satisfy the heart of man. Pascal said, there is a God-shaped vacuum in the human heart. Augustine observed, you have made us, O Lord, for yourself, and our heart will not find rest until it rests in thee. But earthbound man thinks he can make himself happy through pleasures, through travel, through possessions, through drugs, alcohol, sexual indulgence, or other activities. And when these things fail to produce lasting satisfaction, he either tries harder or he tries something different, always with the same result: disappointment. Colossians 3, verses 1 and 2, Paul says, if you were then raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, over the sun, not on things on the earth, under the sun. Paul tells us not to think like earthbound man, but to think like the heavenbound people that we're supposed to be, to think like spiritual people. And we have the tendency to do the following: to walk out of this building this morning and go right back to seeking satisfaction, fulfillment, pleasure, ultimate meaning in the things of this world, the things that we're involved in under the Son. Throughout the book, we find that the preacher, Solomon, the writer, later describes goads and nails, chapter 12, verse 11. These are wise sayings that prod like goads, prod our thinking, exhortations that will provide stability and direction for living, like nails, things that you can hang on them for stability. But Solomon first wants to demonstrate, before he gives all that, wants to demonstrate that man's pursuit of lesser good or things under the sun is vanity or futile, striving after the wind. Life in its many aspects, Young said, is completely without meaning apart from God. If man or the world be regarded as the ultimate standard or point of reference, all is vanity. All then becomes without meaning and can lead only to despair. You ever been involved in something and just thought, this is it? I mean, this is really what makes life meaningful. I went through that I don't know how many times in my youth. I could name the different endeavors, bunches of them. This is it. This is what it's about. Only to end up sometime later, year later, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years later, realizing, no, that's not what it's all about. I'll try something else. That wasn't what it was all about either. Anybody ever experienced that? At least once? Nobody needs to raise their hand, because everybody would raise their hand. The book of Ecclesiastes teaches us that no matter how much wealth, no matter how much education, no matter how much social prestige you may have, life without God is futile, futile. Solomon had it all. He had everything the earthbound man can have. But when he tried to find lasting satisfaction, when he tried to find personal fulfillment in possessions, pleasures, power, or prestige, it left him empty, and it left him with the feeling that he was chasing the wind. It's what Jesus addressed in John 4, verses 13 and 14, when he said to the woman at the well, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." The water of this world, the things of this world, cannot provide lasting satisfaction. That's a lesson we all need desperately to learn, to believe, to accept, and to live our lives accordingly.